Spirit Blade Underground, episode 398. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground, episode 398.
Hello, hello, guys. Welcome to the Off to a great start, Pater. Welcome to the monitor room at the Spirit Blade Underground podcast. Fighting off a burp here. There it goes. All right. Sorry about that. A biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment is what we're doing here. It's also the official podcast of Christian Geek Central. If you haven't been there, it's at ChristianGeekCentral.com, both a website and a community, which I'm hoping more and more will kind of be a portal to what's going on in the realm of Christian geekery in general. I've started, if you haven't noticed, putting news items there of relevance to Christian geeks. And I did kind of, I think it was last week on the show and on the channel as well, kind of a roundup of the news. But again, if you're kind of interested in kind of staying in touch with what's going on in the world of Christian geekery, Christian Geek Central is more and more now becoming a single place that you can go to find out what Christian geeks are up to, both creative types and just hobbyists. All right, well, on the show today, some more of my favorite geeky things as we continue the tour of my bookshelf. I was gonna go see Risen. I thought about it, and it didn't happen. I was kind of on the fence a little bit because it's not a fantasy movie, but it has some of the trappings of fantasy. You know, it's got swords and it's got horses and it's got primitive technology and it's got some supernatural elements, you know. But fantasy, you know, that's not really supernatural. It's more like magic. You wouldn't call it supernatural, but I mean, you know what I mean? But it just kind of has some of the same trappings. And so for me, it's when like one of these kind of historical biblical type things shows up, I kind of feel like, well, maybe I should cover it because it does have some geek appeal, but at the same time, you know, I don't want people to think that just because something is like a Christian movie, I'm going to cover it. But then again, I am a little bit more interested in covering something like this because it's a Christian movie, and I'm always longing to be able to point people to Christian artistic endeavors that don't suck. So anyway, it was kind of like a borderline, I don't know. I feel the same way about it as I do about, like, say, a James Bond movie. Like super spy movies, like Mission Impossible and James Bond. Yeah, you could look at their gadgets and say, this is science fiction. This is not real science. You know, we might be getting close to it or something, I don't know, at best, but it's not real science right now, you know. But I mean, that's such a, like, a light layer of sci-fi. It's just like little sprinkles of sci-fi that it doesn't, I don't feel like it has strong geek appeal for, like, you know, all geeks. There may be some, you know, there's certainly some overlap, you know, but in terms of, you know, people that like just straight action movies or whatever. So that's why I don't always prioritize, like, reviewing a super spy movie. Same thing with, like, biblical, you know, adaptations and stuff like that. So ultimately, it was one that my wife wanted to see with me as well. We kind of wanted to make a date out of it. And she just wasn't feeling like she could do it in her schedule, you know, with her work schedule going on. She couldn't take the time off, or it just wouldn't be wise. It would just bring some unneeded stress into our home for her to make up the hours after that. So so I am not reviewing Risen this week, as I said that I was hoping last week. Maybe when it comes to Redbox, I'll check it out. But in the meantime, if any of you guys see Risen and you want to share some thoughts, I am really curious about that movie. And whether or not it's just good. Joseph Fiennes played the title role in the movie Luther, about Martin Luther, which arguably has some geek appeal as well. There's nothing obviously supernatural that happens in that movie, but it is, you know, medieval-ish. I don't know my history well enough to be positive on that. But anyway, I'm thinking this guy has to be a believer. I haven't done any research, but here he is in another really high-profile Christian-themed movie, a Christian, you know, movie. So anyway, yeah, if you have thoughts on Risen, I'm very curious personally. But anyway, in the meantime, we're going to continue my tour of my bookshelf, and we're getting into some stuff that I really like this time on my bookshelf. We're getting into, like, video games that I have strong memories attached to and that I still enjoy getting into now. Yeah, we're getting to an extra fun part of my bookshelf, at least extra fun for me. And then I'm also going to share some thoughts on engaging entertainment with intentionality that's coming not from me this time, but from our friends at speculativefaith.com. More about that in just a minute. But on, like, off the beaten path, this is, I didn't want to make a full segment out of this, but I just wanted to share a little slice of my life. If you don't like kids, or you're not a parent or whatever, and, you know, I totally get it if you want to tune out for just a few seconds. I'm going to talk about my kids for just a second. But it's geek related. But I just, this last 3-day weekend, ran the first 2 sessions of Dungeons and Dragons with my boys, and they are 8 and 5 years old. And normally I wouldn't have even attempted anything like that with a 5-year old, but I knew that he would feel left out. So, and he's also a little bit more apt. He's a little bit more quick than our oldest. And so I thought, you know, if you know, he's got a good chance of kind of catching on. Oh my gosh, we had so much fun. And not fun in like a, you know, like, you know, trying to convince myself I'm having fun kind of way. I've been there and done that with these boys. For years, I've been trying to find, like, geeky but kiddie board games that, like, I could stomach a little bit more because they had kind of a geeky theme, even though they're obviously aimed at kids, you know, and stuff like that. I also tried to introduce them to HeroQuest, which actually they really liked, but I found after playing just one game with them that I was, like, I was not anxious to play it with them again. Because that game, I've just played so many dungeon crawls since that game that have improved on the complexity and the immersion level involved for the guy that's playing the game master role, that I just found myself kind of asleep at the wheel running it for my boys, you know. I could role play the orcs a little bit, you know, make some noises and stuff, but I couldn't really run it like a game master and therefore engage myself creatively the way I would running an actual paper and pencil RPG. Well, I might have told this, I think I told this story in the podcast before, maybe not, but I was watching an episode of Community, which somebody put me onto, and we got to the first episode where they play Dungeons and Dragons, and when the episode was done, I noticed that my son had been watching kind of from the next room, like just standing there staring at this episode, and all the humor was going completely over his head, but when the episode was over, because the characters in the episode had been playing Dungeons and Dragons, he says, "Daddy, do we have that game?" And I said, "Actually, I do have one of the rule books," and he said, "Could we play that game sometime?" And I said, "Well, you let me buy a few more of the books, the rule books, and give me a few weeks to learn the rules, and yeah, we can play that game." And he kept on asking me and asking me about it, and then I also bought, just for fun, I bought the animated Dungeons & Dragons series from the 80s that my parents wouldn't let me watch, but now I'm watching it, dang it. I'm watching it with my boys. And we started watching those episodes together, and they're really enjoying that, and they were getting more and more excited for Dungeons & Dragons. And then I ran a game, short session, maybe about, like, I want to say 30, 45 minutes. And, you know, they just did a basic tavern encounter, got a you know, a hook to go off to fight some bandits, you know, and then did their stuff and came back. And, you know, I have to kind of dial down the description. I can't talk about gore and viscera flying everywhere, you know. But, I mean, I still have my grown-up version playing in my head that's suitably dark and entertaining for me while I kind of ease off on some of the description for them. And I get to describe environments, and I get to role-play different monsters and people that they interact with. So, for me, it was a completely involving, creative game experience. It was awesome. And not only that, but one thing that it had that was better than any paper-and-pencil RPG game I've ever run is that for the first time, I didn't feel any pressure at all to impress. You know, I don't know if you've run a paper and pencil RPG, maybe you're familiar with kind of the feeling like, I want to make this good for my players. I want to make it challenging or interesting or whatever. And, you know, you always fear that your players will get bored or whatever, you know. So I didn't feel any of that pressure at all. And I ran 2 sessions. They were so much fun. And when I was done with the first one, I was already, like, looking forward to the next one. And now I've been waiting all week and kind of reading up on what's the next part of the adventure is, you know, because I don't have time to write my own, so I just use the store-bought campaigns. You know, reading up on what's coming next and already getting ready and excited to run it for them. So tomorrow or Sunday is when we're going to have another session, and I am totally excited. So I have been waiting for this day for a long time. When we found out we were having our second child was going to be a boy, one of my first thoughts was, I don't know what I'm going to do with 2 boys. I didn't grow up with any brothers. This is totally foreign territory for me. But another early thought was, boy, if this all pans out, I could have my own built-in RPG gaming group. And I have been waiting years for this. And I didn't think that they would be ready yet. But when my oldest expressed interest in Dungeons and Dragons, of all things, I would assume they'd be interested in the superhero RPGs that I have. But he expressed interest in Dungeons and Dragons. And, hey, I'm totally digging on fantasy these days, too. So, you know, I'm definitely simplifying the rules. But awesome. Oh, man, so much fun. So if you are a dad or going to be a dad in the future that you know of or don't know of, but you're considering it, yeah, there is, you know, there is a waiting period where they can't do anything that you like to do, really. But oh my gosh, I think this is the beginning of a golden age. I could be wrong, but I'm very excited. So, and that's just a cool win, you know, bringing this a little bit back more to kind of like intentional, you know, really important stuff is, yeah, okay, it's cool that, you know, I'm having a geeky good time. But I mean, I think the thing that ultimately is so fulfilling to me is, oh my gosh, I have something now I can do with my boys. I can invest time in them that they will enjoy, that will create great memories for them. And it's something I'm actually going to want to do. And so the frequency of these kinds of times that I will spend with my boys and be able to invest in them, build equity in them so that I can speak into their lives and have a voice that they'll actually respect and listen to in the future because of these times that we share together, you know, that's a huge win. That's a huge win. So anyway, just wanted to share that with you guys, allow you guys to kind of celebrate that with me and maybe give some hope to some of you geeks that are wondering what in the world you're going to do with these blobs of flesh that just came out of you or your wife. So anyway, all right, lots of stuff to do. Let's get to it. I've just started my timer, set it for roughly 10 minutes. It's an egg timer, kind of hard to tell. And I'm going to continue on my bookshelf tour. We left off last time. I was going to talk about Final Fantasy III, or Final Fantasy VI, as it really was in Japan. This was, for the longest time, my absolute favorite Final Fantasy game. It was the first time that I was really emotionally invested in a story. It was just a fantastic experience. I've long been a fan of the Final Fantasy games, especially the early ones. I still am. This one I've replayed. I'm on my, I think, third playthrough maybe, and that might not sound like a lot. I know a lot of people that are big fans have been through it many more times than I have, but that doesn't change the fact that I really, really had a fantastic experience with this game. Next up, let's see here, is... Oh, crap, what is this? Oh, yeah. This is Justice League Task Force. I can't really get a good focus on the image there, but this was when, during the fighting game craze, DC, I guess, gave out the license for them to do basically a Street Fighter, you know, Justice League game. No Green Lantern in that one, which really, really sucks, but they got Green Arrow, whoop-de-doo. But then, anyway, I was just desperate. I was just desperate for any kind of, like, superhero game that I could find. It wasn't a role-playing game. I sucked at fighting games. I knew that I would probably hate the fighting mechanics, but I was so desperate, I just wanted a superhero game. So I got that one, and with the help of, you know, easy difficulty, I was able to get through the whole game, I think, on easy difficulty using Flash, because if you just hammer on one of the B buttons, he's got this kind of cool, like, punch thing that can even take out Darkseid if you're really persistent. So, so anyway, that got some decent memories with that, but it's not like a huge game that I, like, come back to. And then we got, Super Mario World, which, you know, again, this is just one of those games that I bought because... I wanted to explore the world. This was before they were really making a ton of RPGs to fill up my time, and so I would, you know, buy some games that I could get cheat codes for that I would enjoy enough. Let's see here. Okay, Turtles in Time, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 4. This one I bought for cheap, mostly just to kind of have, for cheap. I guess $8 is cheap. I can't remember if that's actually, if I got it at that store or not. But, you know, it's a way to have, like, just kind of a cheap co-op game around that, you know, I can play with some friends if they're in the mood for playing retro games or something like that. That's really the only reason I keep that one around for. Next up, Final Fantasy Legend, which this is for the original Game Boy. And I just started playing this again on last summer during my retro game stream. And I really enjoyed it. I was amazed at, like, how
how addictive the combat still was. The funny thing is, this isn't really a Final Fantasy game, and I talk about that in my video of that retro live stream. They just kind of put the Final Fantasy name on it. The original Japanese name, I cannot remember at all. Something Saga, something or other, I can't remember. But anyway, it was still an enjoyable game, and I have great memories of family vacations, you know, driving long distances and playing that game. Good stuff. I might actually come back to it sometime using my my Retron. Tetris, just kind of, I can't even remember, this might have come with my Game Boy, which I still have packed away somewhere in a box, this one, I guess I just kind of keep it around for like when I have game nights and invite people over from church to come over and have like a retro video game night or something. You know, this is just kind of a classic a lot of people are familiar with, and so I keep it around for really other people's enjoyment. I really have no interest in Tetris. I do have interest in The Flash, however, early 1990s, late 80s TV series. Only went for one season, but I guess warranted a crappy video game for the Game Boy. And crappy it certainly is. I've played it a little bit, just enough to know that I don't want to finish it, but I someday I want to. I mean, I'd like to find the right codes to use on the Retron to make it faster-paced, fun, and have unlimited speed energy. Anyway, it's, you know, I'm just a superhero fan, so I do keep telling myself, you know, one day I'll finish that. I don't know if that's actually going to happen or not. Up here, kind of in shadow, is my Nintendo DS, which I in its case, which I bought a few years ago, specifically to play some of the video games that weren't going to be ported anywhere else. You know, some of the Dragon Quest games were only, as they were being remade, were only coming to the DS. I was like, ah, crap, you know, only on a handheld? And then also my one of my favorite action game series of all time, action RPG, I should say, is Symphony of the Night, Castlevania Symphony of the Night, and they were taking that same game mechanics and putting them on an independent series for the Game Boy Advance and Nintendo DS, while they did 3D Castlevania stuff on the main consoles. And I was really more interested in those side-scrolling, what's now called Metroidvania types of games, which was really only happening here in these games. This is Castlevania Circle of the Moon, I believe, is what the title is. This was the first of the Game Boy Advance Castlevania Symphony of the Night clones, and really, really enjoyable, because I can, you know, I can grind, because I suck at action games, but I have a thing for platforming games, just because I grew up with some of them, so those are platforming games I can actually do. These are memory cards for the PlayStation 1, so I just kind of keep them in that little CD case. And then let's see here, Alien Trilogy. This one I keep telling myself maybe I'll one day finish. Honestly, I just couldn't get any money for this, I don't think. So, I mean, if you want this game and want to pay shipping for it, maybe leave me a note in the comments, and if we can establish a rapport of trust, then maybe I'll send it your way, because I really have no interest in... I don't know why I still have this. Anyway, moving on. Now I get to talk about, again, Castlevania Symphony of the Night for the PlayStation 1. This is just a fantastic game. This one, it ages so well, because they didn't go into the 3D graphics. Even though it was a PlayStation 1 game and they were starting to get into 3D graphics, they didn't move into that. They kept it with sprites, and as a result, I think it ages so much better. One thing that's of note for me particularly with this game is it was the first game where I noticed them doing any kind of commentary on religious themes. Now, it's very brief, and it's almost nothing, but Dracula at the beginning of this game says something. He makes an offhand comment about the nature of all religions, and I can't even remember what the comment was, but it just, when I remember playing it, I was like, oh, that's interesting that they're making kind of commentary on religion in a video game. And now, of course, you're going to find commentary on religion, you know, in broad strokes and, of course, across all kinds of game genres. I would say mostly in RPGs, but anyway, that's of note to me. But I think the thing that I most remember about it is not that little comment, but the fact that it's just a fantastically fun action RPG. All right, sorry, my phone died out on me. Okay, now this is Final Fantasy Origins, which includes Final Fantasy 1 and 2 remade for the original PlayStation, and this I bought, I think, when I was already had a PlayStation 2, but I went back and played this. This is definitely my preferred way to play Final Fantasy. Final Fantasy 2 is okay. It actually, before Elder Scrolls was doing it, I think, Final Fantasy 2 used a leveling up system where you leveled up by doing the things you want to be good at. So getting hit made your armor
skill better, and fighting bad guys made your weapon skill better, and using spells, and so on and so forth. There's also lots of ways to game that system and really just kind of cheat the crap out of it. So it's understandable why a lot of people don't like Final Fantasy II. But I'm actually playing through Final Fantasy, this remake, on my PlayStation Vita right now, and after that I'm planning on getting back into Final Fantasy 2, because that's the Final Fantasy game I think I've played the least, aside from maybe Final Fantasy 3. That was a nice upgrade that still holds up pretty well today graphically. I'm not sure why I bought this when I did. Oh yeah, I remember. This is Final Fantasy Chronicles. It's got Final Fantasy 4, or it was released as 2 in the US, and Chrono Trigger. I'm not really going to talk about these because I already talked about Final Fantasy 2/4 and Chrono Trigger in a previous Bookshelf Tour segment. But they had, like, they both had opening animated, like, cinematics. And I think maybe peppered throughout, Chrono Trigger had some cinematics that they added for this. So the menus opening up and closing are still just a little bit delayed. They're not as bad as Final Fantasy VI as it was re-released for PlayStation, but I would still rather play these games on the original cartridges, and since I have them, I can do that. But I mean, you know, I still like hanging on to them because of the cinematics, which I suppose I could just watch on YouTube these days. But anyway, moving along, this is Final Fantasy Anthology. This is the first time that I was able to play Final Fantasy V legally. I did dip into a ROM and emulator years and years ago to try it out, but I didn't really finish it all the way. But when this came out, then I played through Final Fantasy V properly all the way. And again, with Final Fantasy, I can't remember how bad the menus were opening and closing on Final Fantasy V, but in Final Fantasy VI on this one, holy crap, it takes way too long just to open up your equipment menu. I mean, this is a terrible, terrible way to play Final Fantasy VI, in my opinion. You're much better off playing it in any other way that it's been released. That was still very exciting to be able to play Final Fantasy V, especially. Final Fantasy VII, now a lot of people will herald this as the best Final Fantasy. I certainly enjoyed it. It was, a huge upgrade from Final Fantasy VI in terms of, like, graphics and sound and all these cinematics and stuff. I mean, it was really one heck of an experience. But the problem is, it just doesn't age well. I mean, these guys are people made out of triangles that are walking around if you try to play this today. They are doing the remake, which I don't have any particular, you know, excitement for, because this doesn't have a lot of nostalgia for me. I'd actually much rather buy this game on PC and then use some texture mods to kind of, like, get an updated experience of Final Fantasy VII. But I'm still looking forward to the update, because I think it's going to be different enough from this to warrant playing. But there's Final Fantasy VII. Still have the original CDs. I suppose this is probably worth something. Eventually, I will probably sell this when I feel like the market for it has hit its peak. Maybe it already has. I'm just too lazy to find out. Use it to buy some other games or something. You know, I'm not really like a collector. Some of these things that I hang on to, it's just because I'm like, well, I'll sell it someday and then use that to get more games, but then I'm lazy and never get around to doing that. So, moving on, Final Fantasy VIII. Now, a lot of people don't like this game. I actually like it. I quite a bit, actually. None of the stories for any of these Final Fantasy games are really, like, captivating for me. I find them extremely forgettable in all of the games. This was the first one that used, like, normally proportioned people instead of little sprites with giant heads. But the thing that's actually most memorable to me about this game is the magic system. It uses this draw system whereby, instead of buying your spells and having, like, an MP meter that you have to keep track of to use your spells, you have to draw your spells from enemies. And you keep collecting them. It's kind of like, you know, a collectible card game where you draw copies of spells out of enemies. So it's like, for people that like collecting things in games, this is, I mean, I think a great option. The magic system is all based on collecting copies of spells that you suck out of bad guys as you defeat them. Really enjoyable. And I haven't played through this game completely a second time, but it is kind of on my to-do list. What I'd like to do is buy it on PC so that, again, I can use some texture mods. Because, again, although I think this one ages better than Final Fantasy VII, it still doesn't age very well. Okay, that is all the time. My timer was kind of sputtering and slowly ringing over there, but my time is definitely up. So next time we will pick it up, maybe mentioning my PS Vita if I remember, and then talking about Final Fantasy Tactics. I want to remind you guys, go check out the other members of the Christian Geek Central Network. These guys are all producing fantastic stuff. We got the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, the Untold podcast, and POS TOS. For more info about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com. Well, thank you all for joining me on this historic day. The serum I've created will give anyone who drinks it the power to objectively know the difference between something that is cool and something that is lame. The serum is available to anyone who provides a review for the Spirit Blade Underground podcast and is completely safe. Allow me to demonstrate. Recently, Christian Geek Central has entered into a partnership with SpeculativeFaith.com, in which we're going to be sharing some of their articles in an audio form on the podcast and audio and video form on the YouTube channel. So we're going to launch that today with an article by Zachary Toda, published on January 26, 2016, over at SpeculativeFaith.com. The article is titled Engaging Entertainment with Intention. Zachary writes, "What's the worst thing you've ever read or watched? By worst, I don't mean something of bad quality or poor execution. I mean forms of entertainment with questionable content. The topic of what counts as questionable, i.e. we should avoid this because it's sinful, is something no one can agree on perfectly and has been debated in circles, so I'm not getting into where we draw the lines. That conversation, however, provides an excellent backdrop for what I am going to talk about, the way in which we engage with thought and attentiveness the entertainment we consume. Perhaps amid this endless debate of what's good versus what's bad, what's safe versus what's off limits, we've missed an important aspect, intentionality. Last week, I talked about the gray areas of fiction, the blurred morals and a shift in trends away from stories tied up in a neat package of good or evil. This goes hand in hand with the act of engaging entertainment. It's not completely about the content, though everyone has the line they won't cross, and that's as it should be. We need to enter the arena with the proper mindset. Engage. I was talking with some friends a few months back, and this topic came up. Where do we draw the lines? When has a book or a movie crossed the boundaries of art into glorification of violence, swearing, sex, or anything else? One of my friends made a great point. The only requirement you can have across the board is that you're engaging entertainment with intention. Because when the mind is active, paying attention to the content streaming in, it's like having the shields of the Enterprise up. Nothing gets passed unnoticed. When you lower the shields of your mind, you open yourself up for attack. Maybe some people can tolerate Jessica Jones, while others find it excessive. Again, not getting into the debate of who's right and wrong. The deeper issue is whether or not you're tuned into what's going on. Is your brain on autopilot, not paying attention to where the story is going? Are you constantly filtering the entertainment you consume through the lens of your worldview? Have you engaged with the story to the point of identifying what you agree with and why, and what you disagree with and why? This is something we should constantly be doing, not in a legalistic guilt trip sense where the shame for something you may have seen or read crushes you. Rather, engage your mind so you can pick out the good from the bad, the echoes of truth from the whispers of falsehood. Discernment is key. And how can you exercise it without an engaged mind? Every story skews toward a certain worldview, whether with intention or by accident, whether in a subtle or blatant way. Whenever you watch a movie or read a book, you'll be faced with a particular set of values, a tilted look at the world with which you may disagree. That's fine as long as you're engaged and can separate the truth from the falsehood, the pure and noble from the profane and distorted. I haven't read a wide range of stories stemming from radically varied worldviews and tolerance levels, but I can confidently say that I have yet to come across a story in which there was nothing to be gained, no takeaway or thought worth pondering further. Hunger Games may paint the world in a depressing hue, void of the hope and comfort enjoyed by Christians, yet that doesn't discount its powerful messages. The effects of violence, the horror of tyranny, the pain of loss. So far, I've been dealing with the shadowed side of Entertainment Boulevard, where the lowlife lives and the corruption stains. But engaging entertainment is equally important on the bright and sunny side. Why? Because it can too easily present false, overly simplistic versions of reality, which is unhealthy in its own way. This is where typical Christian fiction runs into problems. Living vicariously through the life of a character, we can easily become disillusioned when reality doesn't line up with the idealized existence we expect for ourselves because that's how it turned out for the characters. Not saying any positive outcome is worth a skeptical analysis and summary dismissal, but that we need to approach every aspect, every thread of a story, with a level head and open eyes. Suffice it to say, we need to engage entertainment with intention across the board, examine, taking the good for what it offers and acknowledging the bad for the ugly face it is. So in the famous words of Captain Jean-Luc Picard, engage. And Zachary ends with the question, have you seen any personal value or advantage in engaging entertainment? And that's a good question to put out there. That's a good article that Zachary wrote. So thank you, Zachary, and speculativefaith.com for lending us that article to share.
Data collection complete. Activating MusicNet 1.0.
Well, if you haven't been to the YouTube channel this week at youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral, there's some content you're going to find there that you will not find on this podcast. And that is the first part of my cut down and edited live stream from, Extra Life. The Extra Life charity fundraising marathon that I participated in at the beginning of November in just this last fall. I have now finished editing together all the different parts of that. I'm going to release them really not necessarily weekly. I'm not sure how fast it's going to be. I'm kind of wanting to hang on to them for those times when I can use a second piece of video content and I don't have anything else that I can use. So, but anyway, I'm titling them so that you can also get a sense of the content, not just, oh, it's part of the marathon. On who knows what the content is. So each title will give you a sense of kind of what's going on in the content, although it doesn't describe all that's going on. There's little random tidbits and conversations and thoughts that I have along the way. But the first one is NyQuil versus gaming, which covers the first. And these are short videos too. I'm kind of experimenting with the shorter length videos, seeing if that will interest people more. But I want to say it's like 8 minutes long or something like that. And this video covers my battle against NyQuil, the effects of NyQuil, which I'd taken the night before, which were just hanging on and making me suck at games, the games that I was playing, even more than I usually do. So if that sounds entertaining to you, go over to youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral where you'll find the video NyQuil versus gaming. And while you're there, please do like, share, and subscribe if you like the video, want to share it, and want to more videos like that. It also just kind of helps introduce other people to Christian Geek Central that that maybe aren't into podcasts, but they're more YouTube type people. And as a reminder, I want your voice and your interests to be a part of this podcast and Christian Geek Central. I don't want it to just be me blabbing and showing my face or just yakking my thoughts. Whether you've got an idea for a segment already, or you know, you just want to be a part of the fun somehow, but you don't really know what that might look like, we want to find a way to plug you in and let your voice be heard. It's also a great way to promote what you're doing, if you'd like. So for more info, please email me at paeter@spiritblade.com. I'd be happy to brainstorm that whole thing with you. Guys, as always, if you want to support Spirit Blade Productions and Christian Geek Central, you can donate any amount, any time, or become a part of the Spirit Blade Insider Program. More information on our About page at spiritblade.com. And while you're there, you're also invited to support us by purchasing a download of one of our original sci-fi or fantasy audio dramas for a friend or family member using our available gift codes. Again, for more information, visit spiritblade.com.
The truth will set you free.
Truth. That which corresponds to fact or reality. To assert that truth is not absolute is a self-defeating proposition. Now, lots of things are possible, but our beliefs should reflect the best explanation of the available evidence. I'm no expert, but the information is out there. You'd be amazed what you can learn if you spend some time in search of truth.
The truth will set you free.
Well, in this segment, I attempt to examine the Bible and dissect what I would call some of the churchy language. I just put my script away for a second there. I wanted to make sure the thing was still recording. Oh, geez, Peter. I try to examine the Bible and dissect what I call the churchy language that we take for granted. You know, lots of these churchy vocab words like grace and faith and righteousness and justification and stuff like that. I try to dig into those and kind of breathe new life into the text so that you can maybe see it in a fresh way, digging into history and languages when I'm able to try and get at the heart of the text so we can hopefully see and apply at least some of what God has for us in these words today. Now, I'm not formally trained in scripture. I'm just a guy using resources and a questioning mind to try and get at the truth. And I hope you'll do that with me. That's kind of my point in doing this, is to show that, you know what? Anybody can do this. The resources are so readily available to all of us that have an internet connection. We can all dive into the Word and learn some really useful, not just fascinating, but really practically useful things that will change the way we live, that will bring hope into our day-to-day grind, and inject purpose into our lives. So this time we're looking at the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, verse 32, and in the ESV it says, "And what more shall I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David, and Samuel, and the prophets." Now, the names listed in verse 32 as part of this kind of hall of faith, these examples of faith that the author of Hebrews is giving us, these names seem to represent the totality. They're kind of stand-ins for really the totality of those in history who displayed faith, since the list of deeds followed by who did this and that and da-da-da-da in verse 33 can probably not all be accounted for in the lives of only those on this short list of names. So that we don't miss anything about what might be significant, why these people might be examples, we're taking a brief look at each of the people listed here and making a few observations about their faith based on what the Bible says about them. This time we're looking at David, second to last in this list, whose story can be found in 1 Samuel 16, verse 1, and then all the way through 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 10, as well as a number of Psalms. I mean, there is actually so much material in the Bible about David's life that he really warrants an entire series of his own. And in fact, sometime down the road, I don't know when, but I'd like to do a study on the life of King David for these In Search of Truth segments, incorporating the Psalms he wrote as they chronologically fall during his life. Because often he wrote Psalms that were reflecting on these events of his life that are described to us in the book of First and Second Samuel, and then in 1 Kings. So I'd like to do that someday. I don't know when that's going to happen. I mean, if that sounds like a big undertaking, that's going to take us on an epic journey, you're right. So for now, I'm just going to try to make a few observations about David's faith based on some standout moments, moments from his life that kind of jump out to me as I just kind of, take a quick scan of his life. Now, the Sunday school version of young David's encounter with lions, bears, and Goliath can easily leave me, with the time that I grew up in, with these kind of flannel graph, cartoony versions of events in my mind. And I found that it's easy to read Bible stories and just become numb to the savage and dangerous times these people lived in. I mentioned last week that we so often hear about, you know, battles this, and they went to war, and they went down here, and they fought, and blah, blah, blah. We just, you know, we lose the sense of like, wow, no, people were like stabbing each other, you know? And there was death cries and moans and desperation on the battlefield. I mean, you think of Saving Private Ryan. And in one sense, this was far more gruesome because they were in the enemy's face. They weren't getting shot from afar. People were running up and stabbing people through, you know? It's a savage, nasty, nasty time and environment. So I'm trying to keep that in mind as I'm reading this, and trying not to be numb to that. And I try to bring that to mind also as I think about David, who was probably no older than 19, possibly as young as 12, when he killed at least one lion. I mean, think about that for a second. Have you ever seen a lion in your life? You ever been like close to one, like, you know, behind? Most of us haven't even seen a lion in person. We haven't gone to the zoo and, you know, seen, well, I don't know about most of us. I don't know what the statistics are on how many people have visited a zoo and seen a lion. I think it's been so long since I've been to the zoo. And I think even then it was like really far away down in this kind of deeper recessed area that the lion was in, you know. Lions almost in our modern society are like these fictitious creatures that we only see on TV and CG versions of them in movies, you know. But David killed one, and he killed at least one bear in the course of his duties as a shepherd. I just watched The Revenant with Leonardo DiCaprio, in which we see this horrific bear mauling of a character. I mean, it is horrible, and you hear and read stories about bear maulings. I mean, horrible. These are monstrous creatures, you know. And David, at possibly as young as 12, no older than 19. Killed both a lion and a bear just in the course of his duties as a shepherd. That was just the life that he was living, and that probably other shepherds were living too, even if they, you know, maybe they didn't defeat a lion and bear, but the dangers were very real, you know. And then David goes on to kill a highly trained and physically remarkable enemy soldier that no one else in the Israelite army was brave enough to fight. David himself, not even enlisted, let alone trained in soldier combat. Yet in all these cases, with these animals and with Goliath, David identified Yahweh as the reason for victory. The reason for victory in the past, his hope for victory in the future. I mean, 1 Samuel 17, verse 37 in the ESV says, "And David said, 'Yahweh, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine.' And Saul said to David, 'Go, and Yahweh be with you.'" And then 1 Samuel 17, verse 47b in the ESV, David says, "For the battle is Yahweh's, and he will give you into our hand." This is him saying that, I believe, to Goliath, if not the Philistines as a whole. So we've seen examples of this kind of faith in others from the Hebrews Hall of Faith, people that have gone into battle and trusted Yahweh in that. But David's faith actually goes beyond trusting God's ability. You know, there's a sense in which we can trust that, yeah, okay, God can do this, but is he good? Is he going to do this? Or is he going to choose to do this? Is he good? Does he care? And David trusted in who Yahweh said he was. And his trust changed the way he approached life. Instead of chasing his own dreams and his own aspirations, he pursued the things that God cares about. He recognized God's wisdom and is like, you know, God has things figured out. He knows what's right, what's good, what's best. And that's why I'm going to follow him. Not just because he's super powerful and he's my genie to save me when I'm in trouble, but he knows best. He knows absolutely, perfectly what I ought to do and what life is for. And so I'm going to follow him. And David was described as a man after Yahweh's own heart in 1 Samuel 13, verse 14. He trusted and recognized Yahweh's identity as also not only, you know, knowledgeable and trustworthy, but as the rightful ruler over all. So even when David had the opportunity to kill King Saul, who was mercilessly trying to kill David, David spared his life and said, "Yahweh forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord," referring to Saul. "Yahweh's anointed," he said, "to put out my hand against him," seeing he is Yahweh's anointed, or now Yahweh's chosen one is the idea there. And that's in 1 Samuel 24, verse 6. Saul was a terrible ruler, but despite that, David trusted Yahweh's plan, which for now involved placing a corrupt ruler in authority. He knew that he was going to be king, but he also recognized that right now Saul is king and God put him there. So he was content and he was respecting God's choice, even though it seemed like maybe a bad one to him. I don't know. Now, you may already be familiar also with David's sin. He slept with a married woman and essentially had her husband killed so that he could marry her. I'm not making any excuses for that. When he was confronted about this sin, he immediately repented and mourned what he had done. Psalm 51 records the thoughts and prayers of David as he responded to his sin, and it shows us more about his faith in Yahweh. David had an enormously large and high view of God that was far ahead of his time. He recognized that God alone could provide forgiveness for his sin, and that the sacrificial system was ultimately not what would put people in right relationship with God. And we see that in Psalm 51, verses 1 and 2, and verses 16 and 17. He also recognized God's holiness, his otherness. Like, this God is not like us. He is better, different, perfect. He's just other. He recognized his holiness and his infinite value, which meant that God, by comparison, was really the only person being wronged by David's sin that was worth mentioning. Psalm 51:4 in the ESV, this is really surprising after reading the account of what David did to Bathsheba and her husband. "Against you, you only have I sinned." He's talking to Yahweh. "Against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight, so that you may be justified in your words and blameless in your judgment." You know, yes, Bathsheba was wronged by David's seduction of her. And of course, her husband was wronged by being murdered by David's command. It wasn't David's right to do either of these things. But at the same time, Bathsheba and her husband were sinners, just like you and I are. And sin deserves death anyway. Romans 6:23 tells us that. You know, a day we live without being struck down for our sin is a day of undeserved favor from God, because we deserve to be struck down. But God empathizes with and loves each of us so much that when we hurt each other, we're doing wrong against Him. That I think we pull that from Matthew 25:45. And God is also our creator, so we take His gift of life for granted and we insult Him when we violate what He has made us for. Through David's repentance, we just see how his faith, it wasn't compartmentalized. He had this huge view of God that informed the way he viewed every area of his life. For example, when David's child becomes deathly ill because of David's sin, David mourns and weeps and pleads with God until the child dies. At which point, the text says, David arose from the earth and washed and anointed himself and changed his clothes, and he went into the house of Yahweh and worshipped. He then went to his own house, and when he asked, they set food before him, and he ate. Then his servant said to him, "What is this thing that you have done? You fasted and wept for the child while he was alive, but when the child died, you arose and ate food." He said, "While the child was still alive, I fasted and wept, for I said, 'Who knows whether Yahweh will be gracious to me that the child may live?' But now he is dead. Why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will not return to me." And that's from 2 Samuel chapter 12, verses 20 through 23 in the ESV. I have never seen anyone mourn death like this, let alone the death of a child. I can't imagine the kind of faith required to have this perspective on life and death. But when my time comes to mourn, and statistically we are all going to find ourselves mourning something before we die, when my time comes to mourn, I want to mourn like David. I want to be preparing myself for that now. He didn't see this life as the main event, and what comes after as just like an epilogue. He had his eyes on eternity, and I think that's what kept him from sitting in despair and bitterness for the rest of his life. He mourned and wept when horrible nightmares came true in his life. But he also recognized that this life isn't primarily what we were made to experience. It will eventually just be a dot on this line stretching across eternity. A dot that's the same size as a billion millennia. Just a dot. That's, I mean, eternity. His life was ruined, but he also knew that what we have on earth isn't our real life when compared to eternity. So what in all of this is for geeks? Well, it's worth noting, I think, that David was a creative type, as I think most all geeks are in some way. At the very least, I think all geeks are imaginative, and so they're internally creative, even if that they don't bring something about as a result of their creativity, their mental creativity. He was a musician and a writer, and he had a gift for creative and descriptive word imagery. He's one of the closest things to a geek that I think we have in Scripture. And certainly if you're an artist, which if you're a geek, there's, I think, statistically a good chance that you're also a creative type, and as a result of that, a sensitive type. I think there's just a lot that we can learn from David that we have in common with David, which often makes me a little extra curious about his way of thinking and his approach to life. Now, as geeks, we are often dreamers. We imagine and long for success and recognition for our creative endeavors, whether that means, you know, landing a big publishing deal with a fantasy publisher or just getting reactions of approval from the gaming group we DM for on the weekends. But David's first priority was being on board with God's agenda. He pursued God's heart on this day-to-day and moment-by-moment basis. He wasn't just trying to, like, be a good Yahweh follower. He was aiming to give pleasure to God. He was after his heart. He was aiming to give pleasure to God with his choices. And that's a stunning capability we have when you think about it, that God has given us the capacity with our free will to bring him pleasure with our choices. And even when David knew God would one day make him king, he was in no hurry to claim that title. He was on God's agenda. What might happen if we stopped being concerned about getting approval and recognition from people and instead saw our interactions with others as an opportunity to be on board with what God is doing in our lives? What if we asked ourselves the question, I wonder what God wants, how God wants to bless this person, how God wants to encourage this person, how God wants to shape this person, how God wants me to just support this person right now, how with this person I'm interacting with right now, what might God want me to do, and so that I can act as the hands and feet of Christ and like engage in what God is doing in his cosmic purposes? What if that was our agenda instead? Despite our love for the imaginary, I think geeks also often surprisingly live too much for the here and now instead of living for what's coming in eternity. In fact, imagination is often, I think, our escape, because we will otherwise fixate too much on the here and now, specifically, you know, our fears, our pains, our desires. We escape. We use our imagination to escape the here and now. We tend to, I think, stew in bitterness over the way we've been wounded. Many of us geeks have been wounded or felt judged or criticized by others. And so we can tend to stew in our bitterness, or alternatively, or additionally, live in this kind of defensive caution of being wounded again. But that's all signs of this kind of like self-obsession, you know, or we allow our immense enjoyment of our hobbies to become what we live our lives for. You know, now, of course, we wouldn't say, I wouldn't tell you that, you know, I live life for the here and now on a written exam. I know how to get the answer right on the test, and I'd probably fill in the bubble marked, I'm living for eternity. But you know what, moment to moment, we still live in our fears or our bitterness or our desire to finish our workday so we can disappear into our geekery, you know. We obsess over both the good and bad in our lives. We're just inward focused, and we often miss out on life as it's meant to be lived. David had every reason to just kind of shut down and stay in grief and bitterness for the rest of his life after his son died. But instead, he fixed his eyes on the reality, not just the nice fluffy thought that he hopes is true. He fixed his eyes on the reality of eternity that was on the horizon. He didn't place high hopes on having a happy life here and now, and neither should we. Jesus said, in the world you will have tribulation, but take heart, I have overcome the world. That's from John 16:33 in the ESV. Now, we might look at that and say, I know I have. We might look at that and say, okay, well, good for you, Jesus. Glad you made it out. Whoop-de-doo. I'm still stuck living in this world right now. And yet I think that was his point. We have trouble in this life, but Jesus has overcome the world, which means if we place our hope in him, there is lasting victory and peace and joy after this life that in the meantime we can be fixing our eyes on. And sometimes that just means getting through this day. Just got to get through this day. I got to get through this week. I got to get through this month. Or, you know, maybe I got to get through this life. Personally, I'm creeping up to 40 in just over a couple years. I'll be 38 in April. And while that sometimes makes me feel nervous, there are times on my rough days, it's a hopeful reminder that, you know, maybe I'm already halfway home. Jesus, man, I know I got to keep going, but I'm also ready. I'm ready today, you know? Yeah, time flies and that's scary, but when I'm weary, it also means that rest is coming. And that knowledge can help us push through. It helps me to have a degree of contentment in difficult circumstances, in stressful or just world-weary seasons. And like, okay, this sucks, but I don't need to despair in this. I just got to get through this day, get through this month, this year, this life. Now, my troubles in this life have been ridiculously tame compared to what I know some of you have experienced or are even going through right now. So I'll just put that on the table. But David's life is a life worth every geek's examination, I think. He shows us how to live in the pain and fear of today, but while resting in the hope of eternity and relying on the strength of the God who made us and creates beauty and purpose out of even the worst realities of life.
Incoming transmission.
Clayton wrote in this week and said, Peter, I've been meaning to email you and provide feedback to your podcast for a while now, but I've finally actually sat down to do it. I really enjoy the podcast. Keep up the good work. I've also been checking out the YouTube videos and I'm enjoying them too. I'm currently a few episodes behind in actually listening to the podcast as I've caught most of your reviews on YouTube and therefore don't have as much motivation to actually listen to the podcast. My one comment on the podcast is in regard to the lines that you always mess up at the end of the podcast. I just wanted to say that I enjoy that more when you do mess it up. When you just sail through it, I get the impression that you are saying it because you must. When you mess up, you have to stop, slow down, and actually think about what you're saying. For me, those times when you mess up your lines come across as far more genuine and enjoyable than the others. So don't sweat it when you mess up lines. At the very least, I'll be enjoying it. I can't wait until SB3 comes out. Keep up the good work, Clayton. Well, thank you so much, Clayton. Truth be told, I enjoy the screw-ups more, too. It just adds a little bit of flavor to something that unavoidably gets repetitious. Of course, if I start screwing up on purpose, I suppose that defeats the aim of being genuine, doesn't it? So, anyway, another week, another roll of the dice on that part of the show. Let's see what happens this week. Oh, the suspense. Anyway, thanks again, Clayton. And, you know, just on the note of, like, some of those kind of programmed elements of the podcast, you know, or the intros and outros to segments of, you know, to YouTube stuff or whatever, it reminds me a little bit, you know, as far as like, you know, how can I be genuine in those moments? And it is a bit of a challenge. I'll just give you a little peek behind the curtain. It reminds me a little bit of when I used to be a worship pastor and how, you know, some people would, you know, would in maybe in the more charismatic circles, I'm not sure, but they would have this view of like, we're just going to, you know, see where the Spirit leads us on Sunday morning. And apparently they, you know, some churches have bands that are so awesome that, you know, the lead guy can just kind of like tell them what song and they just go right into it. And somehow the guys running the lyrics up on the screen get caught up or whatever. And, but I remember, you know, just kind of reading some different thoughts on preparing worship services and stuff. And one thing that really stuck out to me was someone said that, you know, we shouldn't assume that, you know, that we should only be listening and watching and waiting for the Holy Spirit to move as we are actually doing the worship time on Sunday morning as a band. But the Holy Spirit is moving during the prep time. And the Holy Spirit moves and creates things during rehearsal. And even when you've rehearsed something to death, that's something that the Holy Spirit can orchestrate and use and stuff like that. And so I would say that I'm never not meaning what I say. Maybe in the moment there is a sense in which, you know, now and then I'll kind of zone out. But really, I think every time I get to it, for at least half of it, I'm like, you know, I'm thinking, yeah, I really do want you guys to get in touch with me. I really do want you guys to be a part of this podcast. I really do want your feedback. I really do want you to be a part of what we're doing and all those kinds of things. So anyway, sorry if that ever comes across as just kind of rote and like a little commercial that's kind of unavoidable. I guess the alternative is to figure out a new way to say it every week, but I'm just not that creative of a writer. I try to do a little bit with inflection here and there I can, but anyway, let's see what happens. Here we go. Feedback. Give me your thoughts on this podcast, Christian Geek Central, the YouTube channel, or anything else we're doing. What should we keep, guys? What should we change? What's on your mind? What's on your mind? What should we keep? What should we change? What's on your mind? What should we keep? What should we change? What's on your mind you'd like a potentially uninformed opinion on? I might have blazed through. I was about to blaze through, but I thought, no. This is a little case in point. Let's just stop. Let's just make a little object lesson out of this. I don't know what that lesson would be, so I'm going to move on. We want to make this show and all of Christian Geek Central as fun and useful as we can. But we have to hear from you to do that. Otherwise, I'm just going to do what I think is fun and what I think is useful. So send me an email or an audio file anytime that you record on your phone. That can be done pretty easily with most smartphones. Send it my way at paeter@spiritblade.com. I'm ready for the weekend. The podcast is sometimes the last thing I do in the work week. I actually try to record most of it on Thursdays so that it's not. But the last few weeks it has been. I've only got a couple hours left of my work day. I might stop working an hour early after I edit this thing. I'm tired, guys. End of work. I've been losing a little bit of sleep every night. And I'm at the end now. I got nothing. I got to summon up all this energy so you don't get bored of me. Dance, monkey, dance! Right? I gotta entertain. I gotta keep you focused on what's going on in your ears. But honestly, I'm just ready to play video games. I'm ready for two worlds to get here. guilty pleasure. long, long ago, if you've been listening long enough that you remember a little blog I used to run called Inside Pater's Brain. Now it's just a segment on the YouTube channel and sometimes this podcast. But I used to run it was just called Pater's Brain, a Pater's Brain blog, and that's where I used to, whatever was on my mind, the fan stuff I was into, and most of the reviews and thoughts from there I transferred over to Christian Geek Central eventually. But one that I didn't was my thoughts on Two Worlds, which is an open world fantasy RPG that came out about the time that Oblivion, just like a year, I think, after Oblivion had come out. And it was being heralded, I think, by the marketing team as the Oblivion killer. Like, it was just going to put Oblivion to shame. So there was so much hype and excitement, and then it came out, and in many ways, it was a very mediocre, subpar game. The frame rate issues on the 360 in particular were just really choppy, you know, especially in, you know, certain circumstances when you're in a dungeon or fighting lots of enemies. And the graphics were nothing to write home about. But the gameplay, I gave it a shot, and I discovered a few remote voices out there that were saying, hey, this is actually worth a shot. It's not terrible. And usually that was like either like some dude, you know, that nobody's heard of on YouTube, or it was the more established, like the IGNs and the GameSpots, who would say, yeah, it's okay, you know. The people that were saying, this is terrible, were maybe like the slightly lower tier YouTubers, who are probably much bigger now, that were really hyped about it and got disappointed. But for my tastes, it does so much right. But then I played through it once, and I played through Two Worlds 2, and I was like, oh, I'm probably never going to play these again. They were fun. They were definitely fun, but I don't see myself playing again. So I sold them to have a little extra money to buy a different game. And now here I am, like two or three years after selling both of those games, and I'm like, boy, I could really use an open-world fantasy game. And I went back to Skyrim. I went back to Kingdoms of Amalur: Reckoning. I went back to Oblivion. I squeezed the last bit out of those I possibly could. Burned out on Fallout 4 right now because the mission structures, the missions and objectives, it's just not varied enough. The activities you can do in Fallout 4 are not near as varied as what you're going to find in the Bethesda fantasy RPGs. And so I was just like, oh crap, I really want a fantasy. These days I really like fantasy, which is good because I'm going to be working on Pilgrim's Progress. Writing that in just a few months, I'll be back once the Spirit World of World of Shadows is out and released, which I think will probably be around April or May. Then I'm gonna, after a, you know, a few weeks of, you know, heavy marketing on that, I'm gonna dive right into writing the rest of Pilgrim's Progress. And it's good that I'm in a fantasy mode. That's where I was actually when I wrote the first episode of Pilgrim's Progress. I was coming out of this like cool, like really into fantasy season of my life. So maybe this is Yahweh's timing. He's just kind of wanting to get me excited about fantasy again so that I can bring that to the writing for the rest of that project. But anyway, all that to say, as I got this little burst of energy, I got a burst of energy talking about video games, but man, I am tired. I'm tired. So I repurchased Two Worlds 1 and Two Worlds 2. They're coming in the mail. They're not going to get in here. The first one's not going to get here until like next Thursday, I think. So meantime, I'm playing Neverwinter Nights 2 again, which I've actually rediscovered my love for. Oh my gosh, there's some great user-made modules out there. I should do like a summer, not a, like a spring of cheap or something. A fall of frugality or something, you know? Because it's not free, but you can get so much playtime out of Neverwinter Nights 2. Oh my gosh. Now I'm just babbling. I need to go. I do want to thank Zachary Toda and the SpeculativeFaith.com website and community there. For lending us the content for that article today. Stay tuned for Farscape Shawarma after the credits, or jump back to episode 310 if you want to start from the beginning. We're coming to the end of Farscape Shawarma. And I'm not planning on doing more shawarma after that, but there is more shawarma to come. I'll clarify what that's all about in the coming weeks. Next week, if God allows it, I will be doing a review of Gods of Egypt, which looks like kind of a really B-quality fantasy movie, but hey, I could use getting that itch scratched. There's just not enough fantasy movies these days. If I can get my hands on like a rental copy, I'd like to review Far Cry Primal, but we'll see if that happens. I'm not going to go out and buy it early. I have been enjoying the Far Cry games, but I just needed a break from them, hence my search for open-world fantasy RPGs that I won't die all the time, because Far Cry games, I die a little more than I would like to. Anyway, till then, check out SpiritBlade.com and Christian Geek Central for more stuff made just for you. And I mean you, fill in your name. Not really, obviously, just for you. I mean, for you, people like you. That's what, that's understood, right? You guys get that. Thanks so much for making time. Thanks for making time for this show. I hope you have a great week and that you'll join me next time here. I really do mean this. No, I don't. Let me go back and let me mean it. Now you're just bored. Oh, man. This is what you guys put up with. So now I do really mean it. Thank you so much for making time for this weird, weird show. I hope you do have a great week. I hope that the Holy Spirit does something specific in your life this coming week that that you'll be able to report about at ChristianGeekCentral.com. I'd love to hear what God is doing in your life. That's something we don't do as much on ChristianGeekCentral.com that would be cool to hear about. Maybe in the Seeking Truth section or the What's on Your Brain section or whatever. Anyway, I hope you have a great week, that God moves in some way. And that you also enjoy something fun and geeky. And I also hope that you join me next time here on this crazy show, the Spirit Blade Underground Podcast, as we continue together to geek out and seek the truth. Man, I was afraid I wasn't going to have enough content for the show this week, and I just got off onto all these rabbit trails. This show is freaking way too long. Sorry.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Painter Frampson with support from the Christian Geek Central community at ChristianGeekCentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit SpiritBlade.com. Thank you for listening.
Prepare for immediate starburst.
Okay, so there you have it. Farscape, the Peacekeeper Wars. I think one of the things that it does best is just bring closure to the series and the characters. It's what I would call kind of like mainstream Farscape, I suppose. It's not really risky or audacious in terms of its, you know, content or its dialogue or, you know, it definitely feels like Farscape, but it feels like some of those more like mainline action type, you know, two or three parters. But it lacks some of the drama of those same two-parters or three-parters because it doesn't exactly have like it doesn't have a season building up to it. You know, we already had that three-part climax for season four, and what they were doing with this miniseries was cramming, you know, their intentions for about two more seasons of Farscape into a single miniseries, you know. So all they were covering were just kind of like the major, huge, epic beats, you know. You know, there wasn't as much time, I guess, for build up. You know, I don't consider it the best Farscape, but I mean, it's certainly better than, you know, a lot of season four, especially early season four. One of the first changes that I had to adjust to was the change in makeup and costuming. Scorpius was, definitely had some changes to his makeup that I was able to adjust to, you know. After a little bit, it was similar to adjusting to the change in his makeup between seasons one and two. Naranti, the actress, Melissa Jaffer, I want to say is her, how you say her name? She had a bad reaction to the makeup, apparently, and was only able to shoot for 4 days. She played Naranti. And so you might have noticed that every now and then Naranti looked kind of strange, like different makeup somehow, or that was actually a different actress in there. And sometimes she was also obscured in shadow for the same reason, because they had another actress come and do a lot of her material, and Melissa Jaffer did the just dubbed the dialogue for her later on. Apparently, she was supposed to have a much larger role, which I wonder if that
ties into the comment that Scorpius made at the end of Bad Timing to make sure that Narranti was safe and brought aboard the next time they encountered Moya. So, you know, we may never know, but that would make sense to me that they were intending to somehow pick up on that little thread that was left hanging at the end of season four. I liked Bracca's modest makeup and costume change. You got a, you know, kind of a more of a buzz haircut and that little bit of facial hair. I don't know what you call that. Soul patch, I think. I think that let me mention Chiana first. I don't like her contact lenses. That was a bummer. I think that some actors can still be expressive, or, you know, and it's not, I don't think it's necessarily the skill of the actor at all, but there's just some ability to express that is lost when you have contact lenses in, and especially when you have the cat contact lenses. Those can kind of easily get out of position and betray the fact that they're contacts, and you get into situations where it looks like the person with the cat contact lenses has a lazy eye or something, because they're not symmetrical all the way around. You know, so you can tell when one of them kind of starts slanting diagonal a little bit or something funny, you know. And so there was a couple of times where I was like, oh man, she looks like she's got a lazy eye or something, you know. Just wasn't quite right. And so if she comes back in the reboot of the series that they're planning, I hope they have a different eye situation going on with her. I hope she has her natural eyes back. The costume and makeup change that I enjoyed the most was for Sokozu. I love the change to her hair. It definitely sets her apart from Jewel. I thought that was one of the big problems with Sokozu, bringing her on, you know, so soon after Jewel leaving, or there even might have been a little bit of overlap there. And they both had this long, super curly, super red hair, you know. And it was just a strange choice. I wish they would have used this hair and this makeup for her from the very beginning. While we're talking about her, as far as like the moving into the story side of things, I had forgotten that she was the traitor in this. I always forget every time I watch this miniseries. Okay, who was the traitor? I can't remember. But she betrays them at the end. She is a spy for the Skarrans. And apparently they promised her that they would free her people if she delivered John Crichton to them or something like that. But anyway, lots of, you know, great, you know, good action and then definitely closure. It's not the, you know, wild, crazy, you know, concepts that you'll sometimes see. There wasn't a lot of, like, weird, gory body stuff, you know, in some of the more extreme episodes, or crazy new creatures and stuff. You know, those are some of the things that I enjoy Farscape for. And this really wasn't about introducing any new ideas, you know, or pushing, you know, body and gore humor, or not humor, well, sometimes humor and sometimes, you know, just horror. You know, it wasn't about pushing those kinds of experiences. It was just about wrapping things up. So I'm grateful for that, but I think, you know, on its own, it's you know, not the strongest Farscape. I look forward to this more as a resolution, you know, when I'm done watching the series each time. I look forward to this more for its resolution than for the actual experience itself. I actually think this thing could have been about half the length that it was and still been great. I think it could have, because without commercials and everything, it clocks in at just over 3 hours. And I think they could have, in 90 minutes, done the same, you know, accomplished the same thing. So talking about the resolution a little bit, probably the most memorable thing about this miniseries to me is the end, when John is up against the wall and he actually unleashes the wormhole weapon. And it starts out small, and everybody just thinks it's a joke. It's like, whatever, nobody's taking it seriously. And then suddenly it starts exponentially growing and expanding. And soon everyone is just hushed in just awe of the insane destructive power of this wormhole. You know, it is, you know, the climax of the entire series. It's what everyone's been chasing John across the galaxy for. And I think it's so appropriate that we see it unleashed in the closure to the series, you know, and it is awe-inspiring. Less so, I mean, we've seen him use a wormhole to destroy a command carrier before, and so, you know, there was a sense, you know, we actually saw more destruction in that when he destroyed the command carrier in season, what was that season 4 or season 3? I can't remember. And I think we saw more destruction in the destruction of that the base that they destroyed at the end of season three. You know, but this I felt the awe factor as everyone just stood there. You know, all the combatants stopped, all the commanders stopped. That was just a really powerful hushed moment. You know. And I think it was a perfect way, you know, when you can't do explosions any bigger and stuff, to build your climax based on the characters reacting to the power of the situation. You know, I think it spoke a whole lot more. That quiet awe that they all had spoke so much more than just showing us more explosions and ships getting sucked in and people screaming and stuff like that. That sense of awe was just a great choice. Stark finally finds his piece, takes off his mask, and he doesn't have a glowing bit under there. That's great, because I can't see any reason they would use that character again in the future, now that he's found peace. And if they do, he'll be, I imagine, a different type of character. And that's great news, because I hate Stark. And then we have the death of Dargo. And I guess I should put death in quotes. I always have. Because you never see him die on screen. You don't even see him take any more shots after they leave him behind. He has the two guns, he says, "I'm your daddy," and he starts, you know, just blowing away the bad guys as they leave. We don't see him take any more shots to kind of nail, you know, the lid on the coffin. And that's what you would normally expect to see in kind of like this last stand. You'd see him blow away some guys, and then in the process, somewhere in there, you'd see him take, you know, get pummeled with like 12 more shots so that it's clear that, yep, this is the end. But they didn't even do that, you know? And so I believe it was not their intention to nail the lid on that coffin for Dargo. They had intended to do some, like, a web series after this. I mean, first they were hoping for another miniseries, I think. And when that didn't pan out, they were looking to do a web series. And then that didn't happen. And then the status of the franchise just kind of went into limbo. But I believe it was their, probably, I have no evidence for this, except for how they handled Dargo's death. I don't think Dargo was intended by them to be permanently dead at the end of this. But I mean, will they bring him back for a rebooted miniseries? Or, you know, will that just kind of muddy up and weigh it down with continuity? You know, I don't know. But I do mourn his death still. He's such a great character. And if they do, you know, as I believe they're planning to continue the series, or at least do a mini-series to serve as a pilot for a potential new series, I would hope that they would bring him back. It's hard for me to imagine John without Dargo. That's not quite as intense as John without Aaron. I couldn't watch a show without, you know, Aaron, if John's in it. You know, I couldn't watch a show without Aaron, you know. I could, but anyway. But it's really hard to imagine John without his best friend, you know. So that was sad. I appreciate the why they named their son Dargo. But the first time I heard them say that, and even now, this last time that I watched it, it just didn't sound, that's not a baby's name. That's even like a grown man's name, unless you are big and butch and you're, like you have tentacles on your face. Excuse me. You know, I just can't imagine them calling him Dargo as he's growing up. So I understand the spirit of why they did it, but it seems like an odd choice. And then, you know, if a series does continue, you know, are they going to, and ain't Dargo's brought back, are they going to keep calling the kid Dargo or whatever? Anyway, I'll talk next time about, like, my thoughts, my predictions, and my fears and my hopes for a new Farscape series. But I think that's about all that I wanted to say for now. I want to touch on the birth of little baby Dargo and just that moment. There was a great moment. There's some great, like, yeah, it was some neat little character moments. One was, you know, like in the middle of labor, you know, Claudia Black, Aaron, doesn't want to, give up on shooting, you know, and she doesn't want to, like, just dedicate herself totally to the labor experience, you know, and she says, you know, shooting makes me feel better, you know. That was just a great moment. And then when the baby is born, well, I like that they got, I like that they got married, you know, right before the baby was born. I thought that was sweet. And, but right after the baby was born, you know, and they, you know, they kiss and it's this, oh, we made it. It's this great moment, you know. And then she says, will you do something for me? Will you get us out of here? And he says, done. And then the next shot is them walking in slow-mo action style, double-fisting pulse blasters, you know, walking into the field of battle, blowing away bad guys with this big fanfare playing in the background. And I enjoyed that and appreciated it when I first saw the miniseries. But now, as a dad, I appreciate it in a new way because, you know, once that baby is born, you know, that was, you know, when you get through that, you're just kind of like on top of the world, you know. It's just like, wow, here we are. I mean, there's fear and stuff like that, you know, but at the same time, it was just this great kind of moment, like, I'm a dad now, I rock, you know, and we made it through this, and you know, it was this celebratory moment, and it was awesome to just see them come out guns blazing. That was fantastic. And then also speaking of like kind of fatherhood and how that's affected my perspective on this show, you know, at the end when he is comatose and Aaron comes in and is hoping to, you know, is just kind of sharing some thoughts and words with him and not wanting him to just stay this way. And she's not willing to give up on him. You know, she makes this interesting choice. She leaves the baby with him, but she goes off and stands out just outside in the doorway to watch to see what happens. And I think the first time I watched it, I didn't understand really what she was doing, what she was thinking, or at least I didn't appreciate it like I do now, you know? Like for me, if I'm lying down and you were to put one of my sons next to me, you know, when they were babies, my instinct is just going to be to curl up next to them, you know? You know, especially when, you know, if they're like on the side of me that's near the edge of the bed, I, you know, just so that they don't fall out, I would want to, you know, kind of curl up next to them and just put an arm over them and just kind of sleep, you know, that way. It was wonderful. You know, I don't know that Aaron would have had that kind of knowledge, but I feel like it was a moment the writers created that was just kind of a father-son, like this kind of parent moment. That I suspect they knew would resonate with parents. I don't know. If you're a parent, I'd be interested in kind of like if you felt that too. But I was like, wow, yeah. If I was comatose, that would be something that I could believe, even though it's, you know, medically, you know, I have no reason to think that this is actually true. But just through sheer desire to protect and love your child, I can see that kind of triggering an instinct to wake up, turn over and put an arm around, you know, your baby that's lying next to you in the bed, you know, that's close to the edge or something, you know, so that was a neat moment. Anyway, yeah, that's about it. I definitely think it goes out with a bang in, you know, in one sense, in terms of lots of action and stuff like that, lots of cool stuff going on, some neat action moments. But the thing, like I said, that I appreciate most about it is just kind of the sense of closure. Next time I'm going to do just kind of like one more, you know, like little kind of epilogue segment on this. But before I do that, just want to say thank you for listening to this. If you've been listening to this from the very beginning, or if you've just kind of jumped on board sporadically or more recently or something, this is a heck of a journey to have done this. Started this about almost 2 years ago. I got this for the Blu-ray complete series for my birthday, and I've just kind of been making my way through it, sometimes binge watching and sometimes, you know, not, and having to scramble to catch up as the schedule, you know, catches up with me. I don't think I'll do this again with any other show. It was just enough that, you know, that every once in a while watching an episode, it felt just enough like work every now and then that I'm like, no, I don't want to do this in my free time. I'm not always in the mood to watch Farscape and to feel like I have to get back on schedule. If I ever did something like this again, I would watch the entire series and comment on it first before I posted anything. But I don't think I will. There's not another series that I can imagine doing this with. But anyway, it was an enjoyable ride. I think I'm Farscaped out for a while. I don't see myself watching this show again, much as I love it. And as much as it still stays fresh every time I watch it, unlike, say, the Matrix trilogy, which I had to stop watching because I became too familiar with it. Well, there's so much content in four seasons of Farscape that I can't possibly remember and anticipate every punchline, every joke, every moment. You know, it's so that's the wonderful thing about watching this thing again and again and again, is there's still so much about it that remains fresh and surprising. But even so, I don't think I'll be watching this again until possibly the new potential Farscape series is done. The only thing I can see myself possibly doing is watching some key episodes with their commentaries on to kind of gear up for a new Farscape series. But that, of course, is dependent upon this Farscape series actually happening, which it is in pre-production right now, or it's at least being written. I don't know if it's in pre-production stage yet, but Sci-Fi Channel apparently has committed to at least doing like a mini-series that acts as a pilot for a new series. So next time, I'm going to wrap this whole experience up by just kind of talking about my hopes, fears, and predictions for the new rebooted Farscape series, or the mini-series that serves as its pilot. So we'll talk about that next time.